You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello everyone and welcome to another History of the Second World War interview. Today I was joined by Dr. Alexander Clark, author of the upcoming book Tribals, Battles, and Darings, The Genesis of the Modern Destroyer, for a rather wide-ranging discussion of naval matters before the Second World War. Dr. Clark is also the creator of a quite prolific YouTube channel, which has the very non-confusing name of Dr. Alexander Clark, all one word. On his channel, you can find literally hundreds of videos on a wide variety of naval topics. Before we dive into the interview, I thought I would first just give a brief overview of the naval situation around the world during the interwar years. This is a topic that has been covered in great detail, some would say too much detail, on the members' episodes, and there will be a much longer series of episodes on this topic sometime early next year as we start the slide towards the start of the war. But for now, I will just give a brief overview of some of the topics that will get brought up during my interview with Dr. Clark, and would cast a long shadow over any discussion of naval warfare before or during the Second World War. There were few things more impactful on the Second World War at sea than an event that would occur almost 20 years earlier in 1921 with the signing of the Washington Naval Treaty. After the First World War ended, the three largest navies in the world, the Royal Navy, the American Navy, and the Imperial Japanese Navy, were all staring down the barrel of another naval arms race like the one that had preceded the war between the British and the Germans. That naval race, which had lasted over a decade, had pushed naval spending to almost unheard-of levels. Each of the three navies had reasons to want to avoid another unrestricted building race after the war, because of cost reasons mostly, but the British had just fought a ruinously expensive war and needed drastic budget cuts. There was a growing push for drastic budget cuts in the United States as well, as many wanted to return to the pre-war policy of at least semi-isolationism. And in Japan, there was also a very reasonable concern that the nation would not be able to keep pace in such a building race. They would fall further and further behind just due to the size of the other economies that they would be facing. The resulting treaty would put restrictions on almost every type of naval vessel, with the most impactful being strict tonnage limitations on the largest classes of ships. This included a complete ban on the construction of battleships and battlecruisers, except for the 2 battleships allowed to the Royal Navy that would become the Nelson and Rodney. This ban would continue until 1937, after a couple of extensions. And this had an important impact on the navies during the Second World War, because it meant that most of the battleships afloat in 1939 had actually been built over 20 years earlier. There were a few ships of newer construction, those that had been laid down immediately before or after the 1937 deadline, but those ships were very much in the minority. It also prevented new construction from being used to advance ship design theory. There were advancements, but they were all on paper, which had its limitations. While capital ship design would be in a period of suspended animation, in other areas technological advancements would continue. However, many of the advancements that we associate with the Second World War would not start arriving until relatively near the start of the conflict. In relation to the naval war, many of these advancements were in naval aviation, with the latest generation of aircraft introduced before the war bringing with them greater carrying capacity, speed, and survivability. Even more traditional naval weapons, up to including the big guns on the capital ships, would advance during the years, with, for example, naval engagement ranges from battleships lengthening out in an attempt to outrange opponents. All of these changes made it difficult to determine how the next naval war would play out. Everybody was kind of shooting in the dark because there had been no major naval engagements around the world since the end of the First World War. There were essentially no recent actions to pull from when it came to naval actions, and certainly nothing approaching what, for example, aviators or armored warfare analysts had in Spain, Ethiopia, and China, where they had at least something to look at to validate or invalidate their theories. Another major problem was the timing of rearmament, especially for the Royal Navy. In peacetime, weapon systems take a long time to go from design to an active piece of military hardware. For example, the Spitfire, the most famous British fighter of the war, and maybe ever, and their most capable one when the war started, had its first flight in 1936, 3 years prior. Similarly, the King George V battleships, which would first be laid down in early 1937, and all of them would still be under construction when the war began, had begun their design process in the mid-1930s, and a lot of their design decisions were even earlier made for paper designs that were never created due to the ban on building. Even much smaller ships like the Tribo-class destroyers would take almost 2 years from the point where the construction was started to when they were commissioned. This length of time between idea, design, construction, and commissioning for all naval vessels meant that the fleets that entered the war in 1939 were not the ships designed in 1939, but instead the ships designed in 1936, or even earlier. With that, I will get off my soapbox and get on to the interview. This will be the first of many, many episodes focusing on naval power before and during the war, and you can expect many more naval discussions in the future. Also, remember to check out Dr. Clark's book, Tribals, Battles, and Darings, The Genesis of the Modern Destroyer, which is available for pre-order everywhere and is set to release on October 15th.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another History of the Second World War interview. This time, I'm joined by Dr. Alexander Clark, the author of the upcoming book, Tribals, Battles, and Darings, The Genesis of the Modern Destroyer. Also has a bunch of videos over on YouTube at youtube.com/Dr. Alexander Clark, and also is the co-host of the Bilge Pumps podcast, where they talk about naval things most of the time. You can find links to all those in the show notes. We are here today to sort of, on a very broad level, discuss naval aviation between the world wars during the interwar period, especially during the, you know, the back half of the 1930s. So I'm going to start off with a fun question. So I think it's fair to say that there's a general criticism of all the navies around the world in the lead up to the Second World War. And it generally goes along the lines of, why are these navies building these battleships? Can't they see the power of aircraft? What are they doing? What is your initial reaction if somebody were to ask you that question?
I usually go, okay, if you're that good, tell me the national lottery numbers for next week. I need to put them on. The thing is, yes, you can see the power of aircraft coming, but it hasn't arrived yet. No one's quite sure if it's there yet. And let's be honest, it doesn't really get there until, in a reliable state, until we're talking about 1942-ish, 1943-ish. Before then, it's very good in set pieces, but you have things like Taranto, which is a great victory, but it only lasts for about 3 to 6 months, and the Italian Navy does go to sea afterwards. It's critical, strategically massively important at the time. You cannot overstate its importance. But at the beginning, let's be honest, it does get worn out a bit. And then you have Matapan, where, yes, that's brought around by air power, as is the Bismarck is brought around by air power. But it's finished off by the battleship, because they are the more reliable tool. It's quite possible that aircraft are going to get to the point where they're going to be able to kill these big hulking killing machines. But if you're a country dependent upon maritime superiority and maritime security for your survival, the only really guaranteed method of killing the big hulking killing machines made of thousands, tens of thousands of tons of steel are your own big hulking killing machines made of tens of thousands of tons of steel. You are not going to risk national security on an idea that something might be possible. If you go back in time, at no point does a sensible armed forces ever do that. Anytime they do that sort of thing, usually people at the time say it was stupid when they do it. It's a kind of, it's a no-win situation. When we're looking back as historians, we go, of course, they should have seen it. It's obvious. But if you're basing it off the exercises in the 1930s and the weapon systems they had available in the 1930s, and you always have to remember some of the aircraft we associate with World War II are, and so these are so powerful aircraft, are aircraft which are really beginning development at the end of the 1930s. They're not the thing available at the moment. You can sort of see why navies are going, right, we're hedging our bet. Because they are building carriers, they are ordering carriers. Every navy has some sort of carrier program going. I'm never quite sure whether I include the Graf Zeppelin in that, but we'll leave that to one side. That's the German Navy, and I can be rude about their particular over-engineered solutions for everything all day long. They look lovely, I admit, but there's so much over-engineering, do not try and maintain them in a saltwater environment. Please. And sometimes sort of it's a reverse. It's like things like Swordfish. I'm always getting told by people, that shows the Royal Navy was not air-minded. They had the Swordfish. And you go, so name another aircraft which could launch a long-range night strike with torpedoes, get all the way there, and get all the way back. And they sit and look at you and go, they start to come up and go, that wasn't available then. That wasn't available then.
I would say, and also and do it in 1939 and 40.
Yeah, this is the point. Do it in like, and also, here's the other thing about the Royal Navy you have to remember. Yes, they're using the Swordfish in 1939 and 40, but in 1939, they actually have the Albacore pretty much coming into service, and they have the full, and they have the next one along after the Albacore, the Barracuda, under development. So you can go, yes, the Royal Navy has the Swordfish, but they have the next generation and the next generation coming along. That doesn't sound that un-air-minded to me. And that's what they've managed to accomplish with the complications of having basically their air service being jointly run with another force which sees the importance of air power but believes the most important thing is the heavy bomber, to the point to which they sacrifice their own fighter arm, let alone the fleet air arm, which they weren't that keen on having. And they saw the Navy as a bit of a direct threat for money in terms of getting the heavy bomber through. And that's treasury battles. Please never believe whenever you see a service go, you don't need this equipment, and they're talking about another service or piece of equipment. It's not real. It's not true. It's a treasury battle. It's usually spurious. In fact, the first thing you can do to tell that something is important is if another service attacks it, because they think that by forcing the other service to defend that, they'll have to sacrifice money in other areas, which means they'll get the funding they want. It's a classic operation, and it's done almost every funding round by every service. It's disturbing.
So you mentioned earlier that, you know, the the aircraft available here in the 1939-1940 era period. So there is a huge amount of aviation evolution between, say, you know, 1918 and 1939. So how did the navies view aircraft? What were they hoping to gain from having these aircraft as a part of the fleet, both as on carriers and also on other ships and also land-based aircraft?
To be honest, they've always got three things in mind for aircraft: reconnaissance, strike, and defense. Now, defense can be anti-submarine, it can be anti-other aircraft. That's the defense option. Strike. Now, here's the interesting thing. Strike can fit into sort of two roles. Are you talking about strikers in long-range strike, or are you with torpedoes or bombs? Or are you talking long-range strikers in terms of directing the fire of battleships? Because that's one of the first things the aircraft are used for. To basically give you over-the-horizon targeting for your very big, very massive killing machine. To make your battleships more lethal. And that's the capability which stays very, very important, right until you get radar really starting to come into service. At which point everyone goes, hang on, that's not really a safe role for an aircraft, and radar does about a 70% solution, and we can use that radar for something else. And reconnaissance is the most important, especially, again, you have to always look at the navies and go, what are they building aircraft for? If you're building your aircraft and your fleet around the concept of having a big battle, anti-test in the middle of the Pacific, or etc., against another navy, you're going to build your fleet in a certain way. If you're building your fleet to fight in a global manner across all the world's oceans and defend your maritime security and occasionally be grouped together for a big battle when it's necessary, but otherwise are going to be securing lots and lots of choke points and protecting your trade and convoys, you're going to build a very different navy. That is the reality. So that's the other problem we get when we start talking about this and start going back in history. The amount of people who go, well, because this navy hasn't done this, and I perceive this as being best based on what happened in this event with this other navy, they must be wrong. And you go, no, they can both be right. Because what do they want their aircraft for? And it's when you start getting things, there is no right or wrong answer. Often there is a, what is our judgment on what matters to the style of operation we're going to do? One of the interesting things I often get told about is that the Royal Navy didn't want to do multi-carrier operations. Royal Navy is practicing multi-carrier operations in the 1920s. The whole reason it used to justify creating a rear admiral aircraft carrier in 1930 is because of multi-carrier operations. That guy, of course, is Admiral Henderson, who goes on to become the Third Sea Lord, who's building the Royal Navy's fleet going into World War II. The entire operational doctrine the Royal Navy has around multi-carrier operations. But then war happens, they have to have task forces all around the globe doing counter-surface radar, various operations in the case of Force H and the Mediterranean fleet, and various things going on. And you know what? You don't want to send a task force without a carrier. Because whilst battleships are powerful, they need the carrier with them as reconnaissance and air defense. And actually, the two together work best. Let's witness 4C. That basically gets into trouble because it doesn't have a carrier. Not necessarily for the pure air defense role of the carrier, because I'm sure someone will write in pointing out the number of aircraft on a British carrier was far smaller than on an American carrier, and therefore that might not have helped with the attack, and we could get into the whole debate about how they could have broken up the fight, the air attacking aircraft coming in, which made it easier for the air defense and the ships to steal them and all that stuff. No, not that at all. But let's put it this way. If you have an aircraft carrier which already has fighters in the air, it's far easier for that ship to coordinate with land-based fighters. And we know there are enough land-based fighters not that far away in Singapore and Malaysia who could have helped out 4C. Trouble was they couldn't be coordinated with because 4C was trying to be under radio silence because they didn't have their own protective umbrella, so they weren't calling at a fighter till too late. Whereas if you have these things, you can start working together as a whole force. And interesting enough, that's of course the doctrine which then leads in the Cold War to justifying the Sea Harriers and the Invincible class carriers for the Royal Navy when everyone's decided, actually, no, they're going to be fighting in the North Atlantic, they'll be able to get air defense from land. And the Royal Navy basically turns around and goes, well, if you're going to be doing that anyway, you're going to be transmitting a lot. So we better have some point defense fighters and some extra screening fighters, which are what Sea Harriers are supposed to be, to help us control the air around them so that we have time to call in the fighters from land. And the whole thing is, there is this doctrine. There are these ideas. They're being worked on in the 1920s and 30s. They do not come from nowhere. That's the biggest annoying myth about the Second World War. The amount of books, sometimes, but also other accounts, and especially in movies, where you get the impression, if you don't know the history, that the things just magically appear. And if you do any reading, you realize usually these things have been in development for decades prior. It doesn't just magically appear. And if anyone wants proof of that, just think about cooking. How much prep time do you have to do to get the good meal out at the end?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think something that usually isn't considered enough, my own personal like biggest pet peeve, and that I constantly kind of warn people against or mention, is people kind of backdating technology, like you mentioned earlier. It's like, you can't take what was happening in 44 and 45 and compare it to what was happening in 39 and 40 for anybody, because it's simply unfair. But you mentioned...
The fun one is always the American and Japanese navies in 1941, and people going, oh, this is how they entered World War II. So they were better than the Royal Navy. And you go, they entered war 2 years later after being able to watch from the sidelines and getting that whole generation of aircraft in. If the Royal Navy had had another couple of years, if the German Navy, the Italian Navy, oh, let's be honest, the Regia Marina had another couple of years, the Royal Navy would have had even more trouble in the Mediterranean than they did dealing with it. Because, let's be honest, the Italian Navy is the forgotten Navy in World War II.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that what the Royal Navy was trying to accomplish, what it needed to do for Imperial defense, was an important sort of driving factor in how it was using its carriers. Did it also have an effect on the type of aircraft that were being placed on those carriers? Like, did it change sort of the capabilities that were looked for and sort of the mix of their abilities?
Well, of course it's governing. If you're talking about Britain, Britain goes, right, where's our infrastructure and industrial base? It's back in the UK. Okay. What Commonwealth assets or Imperial assets do we have? Not much. That's going to take a time to develop, and it does take time to develop, and a lot of it doesn't get finished developed properly during World War II. So, if you're operating aircraft on the other side of the world from your industrial base, you want them to require a lot of spare parts regularly. No. You want to start to try and minimize that logistic strain. You want as reliable an aircraft as possible and as easy to maintain as possible. So those become two of the critical criteria. Then comes up the other thing, because the Royal Navy has this sort of idea, and it's slightly different from the Japanese and the Americans, who are thinking about a big battle in the Pacific. That's their overriding primary concern, which is sensible, because let's be honest, that's the major threat for them. But for the Royal Navy, the major threat is, what happens if one of our task groups around the world is caught by a big enemy fleet before we're ready? Before we've been able to put our big fleet in the right place? We're going to have to get it and gather it from forces all around the world and put them together. Rather like the NATO and ally nations had to do in Gulf War I and Gulf War II. The forces had to be brought from all around the world. That doesn't happen immediately. It takes time. So what happens if those forces are attacked during that time? So the Royal Navy starts to think about, how do we counter that? And they look at their own World War I experience and go, well, the Germans managed to, although they didn't manage to do much with it, managed to turn a strength advantage against us by basically running away at night after Jutland. That's how they got through our line. There was minimal fighting, but there was a bit of fighting, but wasn't much, and that's how they got away. So what we need to be able to do is we need to be able to fight at night, because if we can, instead of using that to go away, use that to launch attack when the enemy is less capable, and this is especially true in the pre-radar period, well, then we can win something. Because, again, it becomes a form of attritional warfare. If we've struck you at night and you can't strike us, we've taken out something of yours for very little risk, and then you've got to decide, is it worth to keep chasing us? Because if you don't find us during that day and you're still coming after us, we'll then attack you again the next night and take something more. And it's the whole thing, it's a sort of deterrent slash psychological warfare operation for actual war. And it worked. It's how the British are planning their doctrine. It's how they make these things work. But it also affects how you're going to design your aircraft and what aircraft you want. Because if you're going for long-range navigation at night, what are you going to need? You're going to need a navigator. So that means you need at least a two-seat aircraft. At least two. And if you're going to fly at night again and possibly launch a torpedo attack, you don't want an aircraft which is difficult to fly, do you? You want it to be as easy to fly as possible, because it's going to have to land at night as well. And landing on an aircraft carrier is bad enough at any time, but landing at night, possibly damaged, that's a very, very dangerous scenario. And again, if you consider the Royal Navy, again, thinking infrastructure, where are all our pilots? Are they based? Where are they trained back in the UK? We keep having an attrition of experienced pilots. A, we don't get the people back to come train our new generation of pilots. But B, we have to start pumping out far more pilots. So pilots and observers, the air crew, are just as important as the aircraft. And the next general thing you get into, and this features into the carrier design, is, well, as just as important as our pilot, as our air crew, are our ground crew, our fitters, because they're also critical to maintain and train and getting our aircraft airborne. And if we don't have good personnel there, we're not going to get the best out of our aircraft. We're not going to get the operations and capability we need. And this is part of what leads to the armored flight deck. Because the idea was, pre-radar, some of the enemy are always going to get through, and the flight deck on a carrier is a large, flat, open space. And again, these are navies which have been, Royal Navy especially, but I'm not used to dealing with World War I experience, dealing with the idea of plunging fire coming in. They know what happens when you have a thin deck or wooden deck and the bombs go straight through. So yes, you're going to lose a few aircraft in terms of your ability to carry aircraft, because you have less displacement carrying aircraft. But here is the thing. If you have a wooden flight deck, the RN theory goes, then on day one, you might well lose that carrier. You might not lose that carrier. That's the damage. Who knows? But if you have any bomb attack, you're going to lose the ability to operate aircraft off that carrier. You're going to lose probably any aircraft in the hangar. You're going to lose a lot of the fitting. All things which have to be replaced and repaired. And possibly your carrier has to go back and be repaired. A little bit
carrier,
of armor.
Carrier isn't useful for very much if it doesn't have a flight deck that is intact.
But here's the Royal Navy's plan. But yes, we have less aircraft on day one, so we're relying on breaking you up or maybe taking out stuff at night. But if you don't get a heavy strike in during the first day, we probably still have carriers operating on the next day. And more importantly, we still have fitters, aircraft and pilots to use on the next day. So there is none of this idea of it's going to be a short battle. It's going to be an attritional battle, a long battle. That's the RN doctrine. And you see this in their operation, because if you consider how they manage to operate in the Mediterranean, where they're fighting battles which last weeks almost in putting the convoys through. It's day in, day out fighting. Every night, every day, something going on. Sometimes the Germans and Italians don't feel like flying at night. That's fine. That stops the night attack. The British don't mind that. That makes their lives easier. but that means they tend to be even heavier during the day. This is what the British have actually been preparing for in many ways. They've been thinking about it. But it's a very different style of operation of your carrier doing that than doing an American carrier operation. I would not want to take an American carrier into a Malta convoy, just as I wouldn't want to have to get into a battle of Alpha strikes if I was any British carrier other than Indomitable, Indefatigable, or Ark Royal. You know, they're the bigger carriers designed for the Alpha strikes with that capability thrown in. Ark Royal has it by sacrificing some of the armor. Indomitable, Indefatigable get it because, well, Indefatigable and Implacable are two, aren't they? Indomitable's one that comes.
British carrier names are designed to confuse me when I'm trying to think of specific ones.
They confuse even me, and I wrote an entire PhD thesis on this topic, and even I get messed up sometimes because it goes illustrious, illustrious, victorious, and one other, and then and you just go, why? Why are you doing this? Why? You're just being cruel. And the thing is, the British carriers are designed around a different style of operation under the limits of the Washington Treaty. This is the other thing. It's basically the American carriers and the Japanese carriers are prioritizing the Alpha strike, and they're not putting in the armor because of the Washington Treaty. If they'd had the, if they thought they could get away with it, the Japanese might not have. They've always got more of an issue getting armor, getting the necessary steel and weight capacity than others. But the Americans, you can be guaranteed, if they had had the ability, the freedom under the Washington Treaty to build those huge carriers from the beginning with armor, with a metal flight deck, they probably would have. Let's be honest, the moment they get into the point where they have got enough free space in World War II to design stuff with it, it's called the Midway class. It comes out.
And the Japanese do the same thing with their armored carrier.
The Taiho.
Yes.
Yep. The Japanese do the same thing the Americans are doing. And what the British are doing, they're building bigger carriers but retaining the armor. That's the Audacious. That's the Maltas. Because none of these navies are stupid. They are prioritizing within a fixed spectrum for what they think are the likely operations they're going to be. The British would love the ability to launch an Alpha strike. The reason the British have what I tend to call a strike carrier concept and a battle carrier concept, i.e. Ark Royal and the Illustrious class, and then an escort / support carrier concept, which turns into HMS Unicorn, the light fleet carriers, and all the escort carriers, is because of the operating under the criteria of this treaty and having to be a worldwide force and having to think about things far more than just one big battle. They would love to be building up for a Jutland-style major engagement, but one of the first things that comes out of the British studies of World War I is that Jutland is unlikely to ever happen again. That's one of the first things they realize. And one of the first things they start building upon. And
that's interesting to bring up because I know that, you know, my first question, which was, you know, mostly just a joke, but you hear it sometimes, especially out there on the internet, is that a lot of people claim that the Royal Navy and these other navies building these battleships are planning for like another Jutland. But it doesn't seem like the Royal Navy thought that at all.
No. The Royal Navy thinks the reason the Royal Navy's got battleships and is building battleships is honestly. Well, there are three reasons which start to come about. One is, as I said before, it's the only thing you can guarantee has got a chance of killing the other big killing machine is your own big killing machine. I'm sorry, the world is that simple sometimes. I know we'd like nuance and complexity, but historians can't always be satisfied that way. Sometimes we have to accept the reality. Secondly, they're building them because they actually are impressive statements of evidence when they turn up. They have a cachet. The aircraft carrier doesn't yet have a cachet as a capital ship. The submarine certainly doesn't have cachet as a capital ship. Cruisers fulfill much of the role in the interwar years of the cachet, thanks to looking like capital ships, thanks to looking like battleships. But battleships, when they turn up, battle cruisers, when they turn up, go, you're going to have to pay attention. Now, aren't you? And That's as important when you're building ships as their wartime ability, what they're going to provide you in peacetime. And finally, as time goes on, the British start thinking about these whole sort of doctrines. If you look at some of their pre-World War II exercises, there's one, I cannot remember its exact year, I think it's 1936, 1937, and it has two carriers paired up with four battleships in a one fleet as a task force. And they're working together. Now, the carriers have cruisers as their close escort and destroyers as their close escort, but they're working as one group. And that is sort of the British sort of task force mentality. The idea is the carriers will find the opponent. The carriers will slow them down because that's what they're capable of that time. They might sink them, but they might also just slow them down. And then the battleships will go and say, bye-bye. It works. It's not Britain thinking we're going to have a mass battle line, everything's going to be Jutland right over again, we are going to be glorious and win this time. It's Britain thinking that was then, what is now, what do we know work, what do we think could work, and how do we combine those two? Because, again, you don't take risks or gamble when you've got the world's largest empire, maritime empire, dependent on you providing it security. You just don't. So the idea you're going to gamble on everything by going, we're going to get rid of all our battleships and never build another one because we can see 20, 30 years into the future when they won't be necessary. And everyone turn around and go, yeah, but what about for the next 10, 15? Oh, well, they might well be useful then. Possibly. And you must remember, some of the battleships are actually finished post-World War II. Mm-hmm. That's the other joy. You know, and this is the other thing I tend to use in people who are saying battleships are a product of the interwar years and myopia. And I go, but some of the most famous and best battleships in the world were completed post-World War II.
Or show up right at the very, very end.
At which point, you have to sit there and go, everyone has learnt the lessons of World War II during World War II. If they thought it was a waste of money and resources, trust me, they've got other things they would rather be spending that money and resources on. And especially if you're talking about the Royal Navy or the French Navy or the crew on. Because crew personnel are a finite resource and a battleship requires a lot of them. So does an aircraft carrier. But honestly, you decide you don't need a battleship in service, you free up a lot of crew for a dozen or so destroyers, if not more.
So you actually mentioned that, you know, one of their goals is to find ships, slow ships down, let the rest of the fleet catch up. So it sounds like the Bismarck chase was a textbook example of what they were going for.
Pretty much. Bismarck, Matapan. I have a title in my book about Matapan. I'm not sure if it survived the editors because they said it sounded gloating at one point, which I can understand, which is the only battle in history to have gone as theorized, which is Matapan is the only battle in history. Basically, the pre-war theory had gone, torpedo bomber aircraft will attack enemy and slow them down by damaging them. Enemy will then be pounced on at night by surface forces. That's Matapan. It happened.
Yes.
I can think of no other battle in the entire history of humankind at sea which has gone exactly as a theoretical battle did in an exercise.
Just how they drew it up on the chalkboard.
You sit there and go, no, there has been no battle which has been so. Admittedly, the British didn't get what they wanted, which they wanted was the battleship. But they got three heavy cruisers, and let's be honest, they almost captured three heavy cruisers. If the destroyer crews had had their way and Cunningham had ordered them, they would have probably captured three heavy cruisers, or at least one of them.
That would have been an interesting sort of story to tell.
It would have been interesting getting them home. I think Cunningham's theory was basically we would lose more ships getting them home, and we couldn't do anything with them once we got them. But I think there were a few. There were at least two tribal destroyer crews thinking in terms of prize money.
That would have been...
How much do we get for bringing a heavy cruiser in?
What's the bounty on a heavy cruiser in World War II?
Yeah.
So we talked a lot about the aircraft involved. We talked about a lot about the carriers. So when we start looking at the AA defenses or the anti-aircraft defenses that are being placed on all of the ships involved, I feel like, you know, I've read that maybe the British were not in as good of a position as maybe some other navies at the start of the war. Is that something that you would agree with?
Honestly, the British, if you look at them in 1939, have some of the heaviest AA fits of any navy in the world. You then go compare them to the American and Japanese navies in 1941, and you go, well, they're starting to be far more heavy. They've been watching for 2 years the British getting pummeled by aircraft. It's been kind of realized. You start off, you've got the tribal class destroyers, always a good example. One of the heaviest AA fits of a destroyer in anywhere in 1936, 1937, when they're being built. First thing they realized during the war is the double 4.7-inch gun. Love it. It's beautiful for surface engagement. Aircraft come in higher because dive bombing is a thing. And actually, unlike in exercises, dive bombers do consider destroyers worthwhile targets in wartime. And this is because of the false positive you get in exercises. In exercises, there's a limited amount of time, and the enemy get points taking out the biggest, most powerful unit. So they tend to ignore the small fry, which includes destroyers. In wartime, the enemy just wants to sink a ship and get home, because they rather like being alive, and destroyers tend to be on the outer picket of a force, rather than in the middle fiery storm of metal and lead. So destroyer becomes a good target. And at this point, the Royal Navy goes, okay. So that's why the X mount, that's the second firing position at the back, the one second from the second stern, gets changed to a double 4-inch high angle weapon, which the tribal destroyers then find actually sends a shell which is very useful for making enemy motor torpedo boats go boom in a fiery fall. They find that the 4.7 sometimes goes straight through them, which creates a nice hole which lets water in, but might not stop them launching a torpedo or being annoying. Whereas making them go boom in a fiery way, it's not nice.
Generally better. Board, generally better just take care of that problem
from
right
the tribal front. Destroyer's perspective, crew's perspective, a far better concurrent. And actually, the Royal Navy starts churning out some destroyers which have all 4-inch guns, high-angle guns, and are basically AA destroyers to fill this gap while they work on it. And again, we go, oh, well, this shows the Royal Navy wasn't prepared. Then you start and go, when do they start work on the 4.5 dual-purpose mount? Oh, that's back at the beginning of the 1930s. And the trouble is, it has proved the most easy development system. But they were even considering at some points in the tribal class design and others came up, putting in the 4.5 dual purpose. The fact it wasn't available yet and wasn't considered good enough, even by the time you get, then it gets paused by World War II and then it gets pushed on, which is why eventually you get the battle class destroyers come out during World War II, and they are armed with these double 4.5-inch turrets, but they're only given two turrets because the destroyer turrets aren't ready yet, so they're using capital ship turrets on destroyers, and they're so heavy they can only fit weight-wise two on a ship. And they're also more expensive to produce and more difficult to produce, and they require more resources. And so you end up with someone going this, producing this beautiful paper, and I've read this a number of times, people going, well, that's because the Royal Navy in World War II learned that during wartime, during the war, you didn't need heavy guns firing aft on a destroyer. You sit there and go, that's not the case, because then the immediately class after they do that, the daring class, which comes out after World War II, when they've synthesized all of them, immediately, when they finally have the 4.5 turrets working for destroyer-sized ships, they have three turrets on them, three double 4.5s, and one of those is positioned aft.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time with the battle class, they spend their time trying to correct the aft fire because they want something to cover their bump, basically.
I feel like I've read this kind of jiggling loose of memory here that during the refits in the mid-30s, They also had to put the old AA guns on stuff like the Queen Elizabeth's, because the new, better AA weapons were not quite ready development wise.
They had lots of fun with pom-poms and various other things, getting them to the level they wanted them to be. And the 4-inch high-angle guns and all sorts of things they had fun with. It's one of those things, it's very easy in hindsight to go, well, they should have been putting it. But sometimes it's difficult turning a weapon from something you develop to something you produce in the quantities you need. And you don't want to have ships going to sea with a mixed armament, because that causes all sorts of logistics issues and potentially in conflict. If, let's say, you have two different types of 4-inch angle gun, which take slightly different shells, if you ram the wrong shell by mistake in the middle of a combat into the wrong gun, that could be potentially quite problematic.
You suddenly have one less gun, basically.
And also one less crew.
And one less crew.
It's also one of the other things I get into with people. They're always going, well, why were they using mounts, not turrets? And mounts with shields rather than turrets? And you sit there and go, well, because of the weight limitations and various things putting it on the air on the ship, actually a shield made more sense, because the turret would have been such thin metal. If it had been hit, it would have just turned into an enclosed ball of shrapnel, which would have massacred the crew. So you could give them a shield which was stronger and in pointing it towards the enemy, so that would give them more protection. But if it did get penetrated, the odds are that the shell would carry straight on, or if it did blow up, it's not an explosion in a confined space, so people are more likely to survive. It's one of those strange things that actually, under the criteria you have at the time, people are more likely to survive with that amount of weight being put into a shield and a mount than into a turret.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and that it also allows them to escape or move away from the weapon should they need to. Mm.
Yes. And, you know, here's the other thing. The big advantage of the tribals was their rate of fire. They had double guns in every position, which the Germans found really annoying. They went for bigger cruiser-style guns on their destroyers, and then were going, well, how are these ships, these puny guns in comparison, 4.7 inches beating us? And you sit there and go, well, A, they have almost twice as many guns, and B, this is the real thing, they have lots of space thanks to being in shielded mounts to load them as quickly as freaking possible.
Fire rate is important.
They have an insane rate of fire in comparison to you. You are launching a more powerful shell, but it's kind of crossbow versus longbow here. You've got about one shell in the air, and they've got about six heading towards you.
Your one might cause
a lot of damage. Six of theirs, the odds are at least two of them will cause damage.
I feel like fire rate is a very underrated statistic when you're talking about naval guns, big or small, during this period. Look, it's a big gun.
It features in the whole way in the Royal Navy doctrine. You start to go, well, why was the Royal Navy more interested in 6-inch light cruisers than it was in heavy cruisers? And you sit there and go, well, the Royal Navy basically worked out that the likely engagement rate, especially if they were fighting at night, 6-inch cruiser could get a lot more firepower in the air than the 8-inch. And whilst the 8-inch can penetrate more armor, most cruisers are not, especially ones with 8-inch, aren't carrying that heavier armor. And if you wreck the upper work, i.e. all the upper structure above the hull anyway, it's going to wreck that cruiser anyway. So, you know, 6-inch is fine. Let's go for rate of fire. Let's have 12 6-inch guns and see if you really want to have a party.
Okay, I am out of my questions.
Okay.
So, I was going to ask you about your book that comes out in August.
Mm-hmm.
Give me some time.
September, to some point.
So August 15th is what the internet told me, and I'm August sticking 15th. To it.
Well, I'm hoping it is August 15th. I know I have to have all sorts of things done by July 12th, so they will all be done and all be in. No, it's cool. It's really random, because my PhD thesis is still behind. It's going out soon. hopefully. It's been held up by academic stuff, but it's been around for years, just not being published in mm-hmm. terms of available to download, or that's out. And the book, going to sound strange, the book came about, the topic of the book, because after I finished my PhD, I had two bugbears. One, I wanted to get away from naval aviation for a bit because I just spent the last 8 years of my life, including bachelor's and master's, talking about naval aviation and talking about aircraft carriers. And honestly, I wanted a brain break.
Sorry for bringing up those bad memories today.
Oh, that's I'm well over that. You know, it was a case of it was 100,000 words, a lot of many, many years of my lifetime in archives. I love doing it. It's just afterwards I wanted a break. And I ended up writing a paper because the other bugbear I'm doing is these destroyers had kept churning up at the same battles I've been talking about. And they kept doing interesting things. And I kept going, well, where is a decent book about it? And then I found a decent book, which is Martin Bryce's one from 1957. And I went, this is a great book. But the trouble is, this is a narrative history, and no one's put this into sort of the analytical context. It's just giving me the history, which is lovely. You want books like that. You need books like that. But it's telling me what happened, but not why, and why they were chosen, if that makes sense. It's giving mm-hmm. me the part of the story, but not the fuller or the rounded picture. So I live not far from the National Archives in Kew. And I like to go there at least once a week in pre-COVID. Now it's more difficult, but who knows? We'll hopefully get back to that. So I went along to Kew for a few weeks and went, these did do interesting things. Ended up doing a paper and presenting it at a new researchers' conference. Sort of British Commission Military History. And most of the audience were sitting there going, what were these ships not in? Why do we not know about these? Why does Canada have the only remaining one? And I have no real answer for that. And so that's where the book came from. And one of the interesting things is you went through it and go, after you were sort of doing them, I'd say after writing the book, and especially after writing the end bit about HMS Nubian. And this is going to sound really weird, but any historian anyone who's ever written anything about anything they get emotionally involved in, and historians do get emotionally involved in our topic. Anyway, writing the final bit of HMS Nubian summary, I was actually quite sad because I'd written the whole summary of these three classes of ships, the tribals, the battles, and their and how. The concept had evolved, and then the Missile Age came in, and basically I've gone, right, now the Missile Age things sort of change because everyone gets obsessed with missiles, so it changes the dynamic. So this is where I'm going to end it. Also because there's a limit in word count in the book. You can only write so many words. Publishers do not let you publish a 250,000 tome, especially not for your first book. I'm sorry, anyone, if you manage to get that through, good for you, but no.
The key is to start a podcast, then nobody can tell you to stop talking.
Yeah, that's
or a YouTube what channel.
I've done with Bilge Pump, a Bilge Pump and YouTube channel. So by the end, I was actually quite tearing up when I was writing about the end of Nubian because she had such a wonderful career. She went everywhere. She did everything. I mean, there is not a single major battle or campaign from World War II you could name that this ship doesn't turn up in and go, hello, I'm here. Where are the enemy? Send them to me. If she had been a battleship, she would beat Warspite for battles, because the rule of thumb is when a battleship turns up and fires its gun, it's a battle. Otherwise, it's a campaign. And just to go, well, you know, just because she's a destroyer, these are counted as campaign honours rather than battle honours. So you have all these little actions included in this campaign honour, and you're going, it's kind of cruel. And she just gets scrapped. I mean, she's treated terribly. They're just treated atrociously. Four ships. There is Asante, which is named for the Asante tribe in Africa. They are a wonderful, proud people. They actually got back, I think, the bell and shield they gave to the ship. they had rebelled against Britain and wanted their freedom, and this is all the imperial past. The British, of course, but the British did let the king come back, and they tried to make things a bit better. And this ship was part of that. And in return, the Asante tribe gave, rather like the story of HMS New Zealand, Asante, a beautiful tokens of protection. And this ship goes through all sorts of operations in World War II, all sorts of dangerous stuff. Barely gets a scratch in comparison to other members of its class or other ships. And you sit there and go, that is definitely what you want blessing your ship. I think it got deleted, the line I originally put in the book, which was what the Royal Navy should be doing today is not just investing in more in defense, but also investing in making sure every single warship is blessed by the Asante tribe or Maoris from New Zealand, because either way, it seems to work out well for those ships. Unfortunately, HMS Maori herself, another tribal ship, didn't get out to New Zealand for her blessing, and she does end up getting sunk.
Coincidence? Perhaps not.
Who knows? Who knows? There is more things on heaven and earth than we understand, to misquote poor Horatio.
But yeah, I think it's the reason I kind of you post about it on the internet at some point, and the reason I got interested in it, because like you don't see books about the smaller ships in these engagements almost ever. Like, no. You mentioned like the last book was 1957. I would absolutely believe it as a person who is, you know, for the podcast my own interest, actively looking for things
with the
like
journal
that.
Articles. I think my journal article, which I think has come out with Marine du Nord, and I think it's been published. I'm never quite, it was due to be published just before COVID hit, and then COVID hit, and I have, because it, and again, you will notice from probably hearing about it, or trying yourself, although I try and tell people not to these days, trying to get an article through academic publishing for journal is a freaking nightmare to any listener. And at one point, I had six going through the process at the same time. And I basically thought, hang on, I'm poor. I'm an early career researcher. I'm from a family which is middle class, but not very, very rich middle class by any stretch of imaginations. I can't afford to keep giving away words for free and keep having it come backwards and forwards, as much as I'd love to. As much as it's the way, apparently, to advance your academic career, I can't afford to keep doing that. So that's another reason why I ended up writing books, because books and articles in magazines, they at least provide some money, and you need to eat. It's one of the other things I find funny about academia sometimes, especially some parts of the humanities, because I teach history of engineering in an engineering faculty, is that humanities seems to have a different approach to the idea that staff need to eat versus other sectors sometimes. The engineering faculty does tend to remember that staff have things like home, family, and occasionally they even remember you have a life outside of university. Rare, I have to admit.
Blasphemy.
I love universities and I love working them, but I do find it funny the amount of times I get told, we've got a faculty function scheduled for 7 o'clock, it's mandatory, and I'm going, no. But of course, the joy is I'm a contract member of staff, so I get to decide which ones I consider mandatory or not. Because if it's not on the day I'm actually at work there, then I have perfect get out of going, I'm actually on someone else's pay slip that day. Sorry.
Oops.
Yeah. But no, books and articles pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully. Hopefully.
And to remind everybody who's listening, you can find a link to buy that book or pre-order that book in the show notes, as well as on the website. Dr. Clark, thank you for joining us here today to chat about naval history. It was a fun time.